This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we all got our ballots in the mail this week, and state and local elections officials are urging you not to procrastinate. With a global pandemic and amped up interest, they're trying to avoid delays and mix-ups in what is already a tumultuous election season. So maybe you've already voted, but if you haven't yet, today in the program, we're going to offer you some guidance or at least a little analysis of some of the races this year and some of the issues. Joining us now on the program is Robert Gerke. He's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert Gerke, welcome back to you.
Good afternoon, Doug.
Sonia Hudson is with us. She is in our KUER newsroom. She covers politics there. And Sonia, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And we have Ben Winslow with us, a reporter for Fox 13. He also covers state politics. He's been covering it for a long time now. And Ben, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to begin, all of you, I guess, with something general. First of all, when you're having conversations, if you are, and I assume you are, with voters, what are you hearing from them? Do you get a sense of the sentiment? Is there a particular sentiment you're hearing from people these days? Now, Sonia, you start.
Yeah, I think that generally people are focused on the presidential election, which is not terribly surprising. But I think a common thread that you can pull from, you know, a lot of conversations I've had with voters is that people of all political ideologies think that this is a really, really high stakes election.
Robert, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think she nailed it. There's really never been, that I can remember, a time where people are so entrenched and polarized leading up to an election, and that it starts at the presidency, but it obviously goes all the way down the ticket in a lot of different races in a lot of different ways. And so I think there's a lot of energy on both sides. Anger is a powerful motivator, regardless who's voting. And so I'm anticipating we'll see really high turnout. The question, I guess, then becomes, after the election, how do we govern? Who can lead? And that's something we're going to have to see, watch unfold.
Ben Winslow, you sense anger as well out there?
I sense that everybody at this point has made up their minds about who they're going to vote for. The idea of the undecided voter at this point, really, is anybody undecided? People that I'm talking to have made up their minds, and they have very strong feelings about it. I don't know if it necessarily transcends to anger, but maybe a lot of passion, you know, people just very much strongly entrenched in their opinions on this, on all levels of the ballot.
Just on the issue of decided voters, I did talk to a voter out in Duchesne County a few weeks ago before the presidential debates. And the presidential debate and the vice presidential debate. And he actually was undecided. He said he was mainly basing his decision on the candidate's characters, felt like he kind of understood Trump's character, but needed to do a little more digging into Biden. And I got back in contact with him today. We were just texting back and forth a little bit. And he said that he has made his mind up now, and he's not going with either of the two major candidates. He said he really didn't like what he heard from both parties during the debates. And so he is going to vote for Libertarian candidate Joe Jorgensen.
Is that an outlier, would you say, Robert, Ben, that idea of saying none of the above? I mean, well, there was Evan McMullen, in 2016. But would this voter that Sonia's been talking to in Duchesne County, is he an outlier, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, you know, people are where they are, and there's a line of reasoning in political science literature that there really aren't very many undecided voters, period. Elections are won and lost based on who motivates their base. And I think we saw 4 years ago, Democrats did a poor job of motivating their base. I think they're hoping that this time they do a better job. But, you know, persuadable voters are few and far between in any election. And I think this one is probably increasingly that way.
What has changed significantly in Utah since 2016?
Everything.
like everything, right? But just look at the political landscape. Has that changed?
I think so. It depends on where you are in the state of Utah, but we're maybe in some parts of the state a little more purple than we were before. You know, we have so many factors right now that are changing things. We had tax reform in the legislature within the past year. We've had a pandemic that has just upended everybody's lives. We've had social justice movements that have sprung up on the streets. So things have dramatically changed, and it's affecting everybody across the state. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot for voters to take in, and there's just a lot to vote on this year.
But I guess I wonder if you think that's going to move the needle in any way. Yes, there's a lot of upheaval nationally, but Utah is a red state, reliably red, has been for a good long while now. Is there any movement there, Sonia Putson?
Yeah, I don't think you could talk to any political reporter or political commentator who thinks that there's any chance that Utah will flip and turn blue this year. I mean, you can just look at the polling numbers and that's not the case. And so I think that, yes, there's been a lot of upheaval and a lot of things that have changed over the last 4 years, but Utah is still very reliably Republican. And for the time being, that's not looking like that's going to change.
But Robert, shading more purple, maybe?
I mean, I think gradually, yes. Nate Silver from 538 wrote a piece a few months ago about how Utah could be a state that turns purple. I think within a few election cycles. I don't think that's true. I think he's wrong about that. But I think because of some of the demographic shifts we're seeing, because of some of the ethnic the shifts we're seeing in the ethnic makeup of the state, we probably are moving in that direction. It's a long-term proposition. But, you know, Y2 Analytics released a poll just in the last week or so that said Trump is at 50%, Biden's at 40%. That 40% number's extremely high for a Democrat in the state in a presidential election. And I think probably shows some weakness from President Trump. But you go down the ticket and you see the sort of the traditional divisions forming. You know, you see Democrats doing less or Republicans doing much better in those other races, in the governor's race and the attorney general's race and so forth. So I think the trends are holding. I don't know that we're going to see a drastic change at this election from what we saw 2 years ago or 4 years ago.
Donald Trump got something like, I think it was 45% of the Utah vote. Hillary Clinton, 27. Evan McMullen took 21%. So with a third party candidate, for the most part, out of the picture, not entirely, as Sonia was mentioning, her voter in Duchesne County and others are voting for the Libertarians and others, of course. How will that change? I mean, Robert, you just mentioned the 50-40. That seems surprising. What are you expecting, yeah, just sort of head-to-head, I guess, with Biden and Trump?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think according to this poll, that percentage that voted for Evan McMullen, I think you said 27%, are split evenly, really, between Biden and Trump. So that sort of shows that maybe McMullen was drawing voters from both Hillary and from Donald Trump. And it also kind of shows that maybe they're going to Biden this time in at least equal numbers as Trump. McMullen wasn't the spoiler for Trump that I think he was made out to be 4 years ago. Again, it was equal from each of the two candidates. Mm-hmm. Having him out of the race helps, it appears, Biden do a little bit better. Trump still right around 50%. I think that's to be expected. I think we can anticipate that he'll finish somewhere in the low 50s, which again is incredibly low for a Republican candidate historically in this state.
I wanted to ask about the Mormon voters and their relationship with Donald Trump and with Joe Biden, for that matter. There was a New York Times article recently about how Mormon women, now this was in Arizona, of course, but how Mormon women there could be a very important part of the election. They're not voting for Trump in the numbers that they did before. And this could be a real spoiler for him. He needs Donald Trump. The president needs Arizona. So what about Mormon voters, Mormon women, Mormon young people? Ben Winslow, what do you think about that as a dynamic in the Utah election this year?
Well, as Robert mentioned, I mean, it's not like Utah, we are very much a solidly red state, but, you know, it's not like Utah really has warmed to President Trump, at least with the election numbers. He's polled and he's won by lower margins than other Republicans in previous election cycles. And that's a sign that there's a little bit of trouble there for him. And, you know, LDS voters, I think there's been a little bit of, some recoil on the president, over his personality, how he behaves, things like that. handling of certain, you know, crises and issues. And so, you know, it is going to be a factor. It's going to be a factor because, you know, when they go to the ballot, you know, how they end up voting for him, if they vote for him or if they pivot and vote for Biden.
Okay, so let's get to some races.
I wanted before we move on, I just want to make a point, though, especially in Arizona, that New York Times story, I think, was 100% on the mark. I think LDS women in Arizona are going to make a difference. And we saw in the polling here that there was a wide disparity or a wide gap, gender gap. We've seen the gender gap all across the country. It holds true in Utah among LDS women. LDS women are still not comfortable with President Trump. And if that is reflected also in Arizona, that could make the difference between that state being a Biden state or a Trump state.
So do you want to say anything about that, what you may be seeing in your conversations with voters or candidates about the sort of the LDS component to all of this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think you have two kind of different, or maybe I would say three different reactions among LDS voters to President Trump. There are the people who, you know, defected and voted for Evan McMullen in 2016 who say, you know, I cannot support the president because of his rhetoric, you know, what a lot of them see as kind of moral shortcomings. Then you have another bucket of people who say, you know, I don't really love the way that he tweets or talks or lives his life, but I think that he's been an effective president. He's a Republican. I agree with his policies. So the rhetoric doesn't matter to me as much. And then you do have another bucket of people that, you know, like both his policies and his rhetoric. So there's definitely a wide range of reactions among the LDS community for sure.
Okay, let's move down the ticket. Let's talk about the governor's race this year. We've got Republican Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. He's running against Democrat Chris Peterson. I think the real race here that seems to matter, and I don't want to dismiss Democrats' chances, though we can be circumspect about all of that as we go. But for now in Utah, in terms of the gubernatorial seat, the real race that matters, I guess, Ben Winslow, is the Republican primary, I suppose.
Yeah, that was the one that was decided effectively. You could make that case that this decided who was going to be the governor, because historically, Democrats have not performed well in a lot of these statewide races. Now, going to caveat that with this is 2020. Anything can happen, really, you know. But, you know, that one was so close between Spencer Cox and John Huntsman, 6,300 votes, I believe. Really close on that margin. So yeah, this one, it's going to be hard to see how Chris Peterson can make up a very big polling gap. The last poll, Robert, I know you've been tracking this. Sonia, I know you've been tracking these too. It was like, what, 20%
about? 57-29. So yeah, almost
30. Almost 30. So yeah. You know, it's
a hard gap to come back from.
Yeah. I guess I wanted to ask about Spencer Cox as a candidate. He is, I'm not sure how many, Robert, you've pointed out that maybe if you count Scott Matheson, he's the first, and he did come out of rural Utah, Scott Matheson, but he's one of the first, certainly governors, to come out of rural Utah, at least in the modern Utah era. Yeah. How significant is that, his rural roots, Spencer Cox, to all of this?
I mean, I think it's fairly significant. You know, you mentioned Scott Matheson. He was born in Cedar City, but he was definitely a Salt Laker by the time he ran for governor. So it's highly unusual, and I think it has influenced the way he approaches a lot of the issues. He's very much, his background is as a rural county commissioner. I think that affects his approach on public lands issues. I think it's helped him. You know, he's attuned to those issues and has been sort of Governor Herbert's point man on a lot of those issues during his tenure. And you know, he also has come out of the legislature and worked with a lot of his colleagues in the House there. So I think that background has really shaped what kind of governor we might expect him to be.
Sonia and Ben, what have you noticed about this particular campaign, the battle between Spencer Cox and Chris Peterson? It's been said that Spencer Cox has been largely absent from the campaign trail. What have you made about the way this particular campaign has played out so far?
It's hard to campaign in COVID, though. Yeah. I mean, the last thing you want to be doing is going out and shaking hands and kissing babies. So this is one of those, everything is unusual when it comes to campaigning. Every party has had difficulties campaigning. So this is a little different, but he has been out there. And I think to his credit, in a lot of ways, what you've seen is he's gotten out there earlier. And that certainly gave him a little bit more of an edge in the primary because he began his campaign a lot earlier than others. There was a lot of criticism, I believe, leveled when he was when he announced very early on that he was going to run for governor. And in hindsight, it almost looks like it was a smarter strategic move because he had a lot more time to get out there, get his name known. He went around the state, did these service projects and things like that, along with that were basically campaign stops that doubled as service projects. And you get your name out there, you get that name recognition that kind of helps you. By contrast, you know, the Huntsman campaign had to kind of almost suspend campaigning or pivot because members of their staff and the candidate himself contracted COVID-19.
And if I could just expand on that a little bit, I think it's sort of the virus has shaped all of our politics this time. And we've seen it at presidential level where we're, you know, canceling debates and we're not doing these big rallies. But it's definitely shaped things at the local level because, you know, for a guy like Chris Peterson, he's not well known. You can't get your name out there unless you raise a lot of money. You can't do the retail politicking the way we used to be able to do. You can't outwork your opponent, and you can't outraise your opponent because you don't have the name recognition. And so I think it's really been a handicap on all of the challengers up and down the ticket, not just on the governor's side, but you know, if you in any of these races, it's been influence shaped the entire election seasons, like all of our lives have been disrupted and shaped by COVID for the last several months.
It seems like when Democrats have made gains in this state, it took a lot of door-to-door, just as you said, Robert, retail politics. That was getting out, pressing the flesh. In the age of COVID, you just can't do that. So it's another disadvantage for Dems in this state, I guess.
And we see, like I was saying, the sort of returning to the normal, traditional, historical levels. I mean, if Chris Peterson finishes around 29-30%, that's almost exactly where Democrats have finished for the last four elections. For governor. And so, you know, it just kind of the trends go back to the normal historical trends. Because again, you can't change the narrative if you can't campaign the way you'd like to.
Let's talk about the attorney general race. We have the Republican incumbent, Sean Reyes. He's been Utah's attorney general since 2013. He's being challenged by a Democrat who has decent name recognition, Greg Skordas. He's a well-known attorney. He's been in the political arena before. But this is another one of those statewide races, which is a challenge for Democrats, of course. Ben Winslow, talk a little bit about this particular race. I guess we could say that Sean Reyes took a good beating in the primary. It was another primary struggle. It was a tough one for him.
Yeah, that was one that I think surprised a lot of people because that got, you know, pretty close. At least a lot closer than I think if you're an incumbent you want to do in these types of races. David Levitt, the Utah County Attorney, really went after him. And we've seen a little bit more aggression also from Greg Skordas, who's the Democratic candidate for the Attorney General. This is another one where the Attorney General still enjoys that incumbent advantage, at least at this point. But yeah, it's been interesting to see this race kind of play out where the incumbent is sweating a little bit, maybe not too much because they still enjoy that advantage, but they're still sweating a little bit, it looks like.
Sonia, anything to say about the Attorney General's race? Have you noticed anything there that's been remarkable from your point of view?
The only thing that I would add to Ben's point is that, you know, with that incumbent advantage, the attorney general is perhaps not the sexiest race on the ballot. It's not necessarily that attention grabbing. And so I think that only increases the incumbent advantage because, you know, it's just not a race that people are necessarily paying that close attention to. It's, you know, it's not like the race for governor or for president or Congress or something like that.
And I think we also saw Reyes take the approach that we talked about with Spencer Cox, and that is you don't need to campaign. You don't need to engage with your opponent because, you know, your best bet is to pretend they don't exist. Don't give them the oxygen and then just kind of coast to victory. And I think that's what we're seeing with Reyes. I mean, the big debate now is the debate over the debates in the attorney general's race, where Skordis is accusing Reyes of dodging debates. And there seems to be some indication that he has kind of done that. They're only going to have one debate. It's going to be October 21st, I think, Ben, is that right?
It's next week. I know that much.
Yeah, it's at the end of the month after a lot of people have already voted. And I think that's a calculated decision by the Reyes team to not give Skordis any, because we saw Reyes get beat up pretty good by David Levitt in the previous debate. I think Levitt proved that Reyes had some vulnerabilities. And I think to the extent that Reyes has been able to avoid engaging with Skordis, it's insulated him from having to answer for his record in a lot of ways.
Robert Gerke, he's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, along with Sonia Hudson, covers politics for KUER, and Ben Winslow, he's a reporter for Fox 13. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hey everyone, it's Doug Fabrizio. Just taking a quick moment to say thank you so much for contributing during our fall fund drive. KUER always has been and always will be a listener-powered public service. I'm really happy to say we met all of our fundraising goals. Our station is going to be strong heading into Election Day or whatever comes our way in 2021. Now, of course, you can still donate. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We have with us today a panel of political reporters helping us break down the 2020 ballot, which most of you should have received in the mail this week. You'll be choosing a new governor, a new attorney general. All of the state's congressional seats are in play, including the hotly contested 4th District, where Democrat Ben McAdams faces a tough test against Republican challenger Burgess Owens. And then there are 7 amendments to the Constitution you'll have to vote on. It's a lot. Joining us for the hour is Robert Gerke, a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, Sonia Hudson in the KUER newsroom. She covers politics for us. And Ben Winslow, he's a reporter for Fox 13.
Let's talk about some of the congressional races. In the 1st District, Rob Bishop is retiring. He's been in that position for nearly 17 years, I think it is. What's it going to be like, Robert Gerke, Ben Winslow? You guys have been around the state for a lot longer than Sonia has. What's it going to be like without Rob Bishop in the 1st Congressional District?
Quiet, which isn't what it is right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Congressman Bishop's been a figure, a leading figure, especially on rural lands issues from the conservative standpoint, right? His opponent was not necessarily the most conservative in the primary, in the Republican primary, but he's going to be much younger, and I think it's I think Rob Bishop going into retirement probably, you could argue, signals a shift in the way that district's represented. It's less focused on rural lands issues and more focused on sort of the Hill Air Force Base stuff, which has always been a major focus, but the growing population in Davis County and Weber County.
The Republican running in that position is Blake Moore, we should mention. He's new to the game for the most part. Darren Perry is the Democrat. Say a little bit about Darren Perry. Sonia, I'm not sure if you've been covering this particular race, but any of you here, he is a tribal council member with the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation. I'm not sure, has there ever been a Native American in the congressional delegation? And what kind of dimension do you think that adds to this particular race?
I haven't been covering this race super closely. Our other politics reporter, Emily Means, has. But what I will say about Darren Perry is that, and this race in general, is that the two of them are pretty close together on a lot of issues. I think that, having a Native member of Congress would, add some diversity, certainly, to our congressional delegation. And yeah, again, he and Blake Moore are very close together on a lot of issues. But I mean, the big difference is the DNR is next to their name. And this is such a Republican district that I think that's what's going to end up making the difference.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I was excited to see Darren run. I think he's brings an important voice to the race. But I, as Sonia mentioned, this is a very, very, very heavily leaning Republican district. I believe the second most, it's either the first or the third are the most Republican heavy districts in the state. And it's not just an uphill battle. It's a steep, steep uphill war to try to get to make any headway in this district. And it's unlikely that Darren is going to be able to beat Blake Moore in this district.
What about the second congressional district where you have Republican Representative Chris Stewart? He's looking for a fifth term. He's running against a Democrat by the name of Cale Weston. He's a writer, a teacher, former U.S. State Department official. I guess it's fair to say that Chris Stewart has been kind of a warrior for Donald Trump? Certainly an outspoken.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we saw during the impeachment hearings that Chris Stewart was part of that team that was running interference for the president. He's been a pretty profound apologist during the 4 years that President Trump has been in. And I thought that might come back to haunt him a little bit. But, the second district, again, Republican-leaning district, a lot of rural voters in there. Cale, I've known Cale. Actually, I went to college with Cale. I've known him for a long time. He's a bright guy. He brings a really impressive resume. But again, the dynamics, sort of the fundamentals of politics in Utah and in the second district, I think might be too much to overcome this time.
Ben Menzel, what do you think about that particular race?
The district is it gets a chunk of Salt Lake County, but it stretches all the way down to Washington County. And Washington County is very conservative, and that's a big voting block. So, you got to get Washington, you got to get Kane, you got to get chunks of rural Utah. Certainly what you could expect on an election night is Congressman Stewart does not do so well in Salt Lake County. That will probably surprise no one, but the fact is that the rural areas will no doubt probably carry him.
Sonia, anything to say about this second district? Or let me just throw in the third while we're at it, where Republican Representative John Curtis.
Yeah, the third congressional district is in some ways similar to the race for the first congressional district, where you have a moderate Democrat and a moderate Republican. They're very, close together on a lot of issues. And, Curtis, this would be his second full term. And again, I really think it's going to come down next to the D's and R's next to their names. John Curtis has done a good job of, focusing a lot of his time and effort on issues that really impact his district. He worked on this big piece of legislation that transferred some land from the federal government to local governments in Emory County. Public lands are a really big deal in that district, things like that. And his challenger, Devin Thorpe, is, wants to take kind of a similar approach. But I think that when you're talking about incumbent advantage, that's definitely a big factor here too.
I pulled up the data while we were talking here, just to see these partisan leans that I was talking about. And the third district is Republicans have a 25% advantage in there. And in the first district, it's a 26% advantage. These are just overwhelming numbers for any Democrat to overcome, really. And then with the Curtis race, you throw in the advantage of incumbency, and it really just becomes almost impossible to overcome that kind of advantage.
Well, you don't have the same particulars going on in the fourth congressional district. Let's talk about what is probably the most competitive race.
This is where the fight is.
Right? This is the fourth district. So let me just set the stage for this. This is, of course, between the Democrat as the incumbent, which is unique in Utah anyway, Ben McAdams. He's being challenged by Republican Burgess Owens. Before we get to the particulars of the candidates themselves, maybe Robert, Sonia, the rest of you, describe the district itself. Because Robert, one thing that was interesting is you've talked about it as kind of an evolving district. It's sort of Republican, but it seems to be shifting in some way.
Yeah, it's sort of Republican. It's just a little bit. It's not the typical Republican you see in some of the other other areas. I think it's more of a suburban soccer mom kind of Republicanism, and you see that in areas like in Cottonwood Heights and Draper that used to be very Republican and are shifting a little bit more blue. Ben McAdams did very well, for example, in the Cottonwood Heights area in the last election. It's offset a little bit by some of the conservative growth in South Jordan and Harriman, but that's where the population is growing. And it's just, like I said, cut from a different cloth. These are not the rural Republican voters that we talk about in the first and third and even the second district. They're soccer moms and so forth. And that's why I think when Ben McAdams looked at running for Congress the first time, he chose, and why Jim Matheson, when he ran for Congress, looked at this fourth district and thought, this is the one that we can win.
You're seeing ads everywhere on television for both of
you them. Can't turn on your TV without seeing these
things. What does that say, Ben Winslow and Sonia Hudson?
This is why you just don't have cable.
No, that's a very bad thing, Sonia. You want cable.
They're one after the other, and they're coming from different places. I mean, I guess, Ben Winslow, that what that tells us is there's a lot of money being spent on this race.
And it's coming from all over, every PAC and all these congressional committees and things. Yeah, there's a lot of money being spent on this race, eclipsing every single other race in the state. And this is because it is just a battleground. I mean, you look at McAdams won against incumbent Representative Mia Love in the last election cycle by about 700 votes. It's that close of a district. It really is the swing district.
And I think I was just going to ask, in what ways is Burgess Owens like Mia Love? I mean, what's different about all of this now?
Well, I think Burgess Owens is running a much more conservative campaign, running a lot harder to the right than Mia Love did. I think she tried to find that middle, because you don't win the fourth district on the extremes. You win it in that moderate middle. And that's how Jim Matheson's won it. That's how Mia Love won it. That's how Ben McAdams won it. Burgess is trying to just fire up his base, run as a Trump soldier. And I think that's probably not a good calculus for him. I think I don't think that's how you win this district, because if you look around at the four districts in the state, the fourth district, it's going to have the most trouble in the fourth district of any of the race, of any of the districts in the state.
Sonia Hudson, what do you make of the fourth congressional district in terms of how tight it seems to be? And I'm wondering what you saw in the debate that might have been interesting.
Yeah, so I think that Robert really hit the nail on the head there. I mean, McAdams has run, you know, back in 2018, and he's continuing it now, a really moderate campaign. He's run it in the middle. Burgess Owens is running it much further to the right. And I think you really saw that play out in the debate on Monday night. You know, McAdams talked a lot about reaching across the aisle and how he stands up to his own party, which if you look at his voting record, he is definitely one of the most independent Democrats. But in general, and you just look at parties in general, members of Congress tend to vote with their party. And then you have Burgess Owens, who is very aligned with the Republican party, the Republican establishment. You know, he spoke at the Republican National Convention. He has talked about what a big supporter of President Donald Trump he is. And you really saw that difference play out there. And a big sticking point in that debate was about health care, which obviously is a really important issue. It affects all types of people. And basically kind of what it came down to is it was a pretty almost nasty back and forth. Ben McAdams called out Burgess Owens for, up until a few weeks ago, saying that he supported repealing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, on his website. And it now does not say that. And Owens really dug in and said, no, I, you know, didn't say that. My website did not say that I supported removing pre-existing conditions. So they got kind of bogged down in the specifics there of, like, did it say repeal Affordable Care Act? Did it say repeal
protections for people with pre-existing conditions. You know, if you go onto the Internet Archive, which takes snapshots of websites, you can go back and see that until at least the end of August, Owen's website did say that he supported repealing the Affordable Care Act. He has now changed that. He now says that he does not support repealing Obamacare. And so there was a lot of back and forth on that. And that kind of became kind of a sticking point there. And they both have different ideas about how to bring down the healthcare costs. McAdams has talked a lot about these things called reinsurance programs, which basically are like insurance for insurance companies to help bring down premiums. He's worked during his time in Congress on bringing down the cost of prescription drugs. Owens, you know, takes a more Republican approach to it. He talks a lot about transparency and choice in healthcare. You know, one idea he floated on Monday was to be able to, you know, take your health insurance plan from one employer to another. So that was definitely a big point of contention there.
Policy at a debate in 2020?
I know. Amazing.
That is amazing. Go ahead, Roberts. Yeah.
I was just going to say before we moved on, I think it's probably fair to say that McAdams probably wouldn't have won this seat 2 years ago had it not been for the three ballot initiatives that were just drove a huge spike in turnout for a mid-year election. And as Ben noted, he barely won it. I think this year the turnout's going to be a little bit, obviously presidential elections, people are going to turn out. As we talked about at the outset, there's going to be huge turnout anyway. The polling right now seems to show that Ben's ahead, although the polling's been a little bit all over the place. It's anywhere between 4 points and 10 points. I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. I think Ben's probably got a lead right now, but you know, we've got a few weeks before ballots are in and counted. And so we have to wait and see how this one plays out.
Robert Gerke, he's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. We also have with us Sonia Hudson of KUER. She covers politics for us. And Ben Winslow, he's a reporter for Fox 13. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER connects you to your community and brings you the facts about what's happening across our state. As part of our service-driven mission, we value your input. What issues should our reporters be covering where you live? Whose stories should we be telling? Do you have a question about a program or a story you heard on the station? By answering a few short questions, you can help us improve our statewide service. Consider leaving your feedback at KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ballots began arriving in mailboxes across the state this week, which is giving us a chance to talk about some of the races and the surprisingly large number of constitutional amendments for voters to decide on this year. We have with us Sonia Hudson from our newsroom, Ben Winslow of Fox 13, and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Now, a lot of what drove turnout in 2018 were these ballot initiatives like medical marijuana and expanding Medicaid. But this year, there aren't any. What we do have are constitutional amendments for voters to consider, and not a few. There are seven of these amendments. So let's talk about those. Ben Winslow, you go first.
There's a lot going on here. So the way it works is, and people kind of get these things a little confused. A ballot initiative is brought forth by the people to change law. A constitutional amendment is when the legislature has to put it on the ballot to amend the Constitution, to deal with the changes in the Constitution. And we have so many. I'm sorry, all of Utah, this ballot is going to be insane this year. But we have a lot of different issues. You've got gender neutral language. You're going to possibly amend the Constitution to include women because some sections of the Constitution say men only. So that's on there. The other big ones are removing references to slavery in 2020. We're going to remove references to slavery from the Utah Constitution. And then we've got the education fight over education funding that voters will have to decide whether the income tax, which is earmarked exclusively for education, gets amended to include some social services. You've got water issues that you get to deal with, which are Salt Lake City technically controls a lot of the water outside of Salt Lake City's jurisdictions, but making sure that they don't just say, hey, Sandy, we don't like you anymore and you can't have water anymore. The right to hunt and fish,
right
too.
To hunt, yeah.
Whether you, there will be a constitutional
right. You can't forget that one.
to hunt and fish. And that one will be interesting to watch, too, to see how some of these pass, and if voters are paying attention to these. Some of these seem kind of, I think a lot of your listeners would say, well, of course, why not? But this is going to really come down to that you have to, in order to make these changes, you have to have voters approve these changes. And we're going to see if voters make it that far down the ballot to do it.
So what do you make of? So there's Amendment A, removing that gender-specific language, Ben, you were mentioning. Amendment B, outlining when legislators meet eligibility requirements. There didn't seem to be much opposition to that one. Didn't seem to be much opposition to C, which is, as you said, Robert, removing an exception for slavery in the state constitution. Most seemed on board with that. Were there many that were terribly controversial? We'll talk a little bit more about Amendment G here in a moment, but were some of these just sort of message amendments?
I think the issue is this, is the legislature has the power and the authority to modify law. You know, you want to change a section of code, legislature can go right ahead and do it. But when you start changing the Constitution, you have to take it back to the voters. It's just the process that you have to go through. A lot of the things that were maybe controversial about some of these amendments have already been negotiated in the process of getting this before the legislature to get on the ballot, but you still got to get it through the voters.
And I think there is some value in sending messages at some point, because obviously we don't actively have slavery in Utah right now. So taking it out of the Constitution is a message, but I think it's an important one. Similarly, you know, including gender neutral language in the Constitution, I think is a message, but it's an important one. The hunting one's interesting because that's more of a precaution. The sponsor told me when he was sponsoring it that he is concerned that outside groups are going to run initiatives to restrict hunting. And he thinks having a constitutional protection for it in the Constitution is valuable. I don't think we've seen any efforts in that regard yet, but he worries about what could happen down the road. So, yeah, a lot of them are messages, but messages can have some value too.
So, Sonia, what do you make of all those amendments?
Yeah, I think that definitely a lot of them are messages that can potentially open up the conversation about other things. Take the removing the mention of slavery from the Constitution, for example. That in the section in the Constitution says that, you know, slavery is allowed as a form of punishment for a crime. And when this was brought up back in 2019, they actually modified it a little bit. The resolution that passed that then became the proposed amendment on the ballot, it was changed to say that, you know, this is not going to change the way that our criminal justice system is currently run. But I think that this could potentially, I'm not saying that the next conversation will, you know, necessarily gain traction, but it could be a way to open up conversations about, you know, prison labor, things like that. And so, again, a change that is just really a message that could potentially open the door for some real changes down the line.
Let me just ask you one more thing about an amendment. This is Amendment G. We're running out of time, but this is an amendment that allows income and property tax revenue that is set aside for education to be used for programs that support children and people with disabilities. What's at the heart of this particular amendment? Robert Gerke, you start. Like, why did lawmakers set it up this way?
Well, I mean, as Ben mentioned, income taxes have always been earmarked to public education. In the 90s, they added higher education. Income taxes have been growing a lot faster than sales taxes. And so lawmakers are in a pinch. They tried to do tax reform. They weren't able to get that done. They had to end up having to repeal it. And so now they're looking to get a little bit of flexibility by adding these programs for children and disabled Utahns to the income tax. Basically, what it boils down to is they've got this pie and they're going to change the way they slice it up. And the question I think the voters have to decide is, are we actually, do we like the way they're changing how we vote, how they slice it up? And does this mean smaller slices for education? you know, it's the same pie. It's just they're going to be divvying it up differently. I think UEA got on board with this because part of the incentive that the legislators gave them is they said, well, we're going to, at a bare minimum, fund enrollment growth in, you know, the number of students that are in schools and an inflationary adjustment. So you're going to see increases in education. They gave them that guarantee in statute, not in the Constitution. So they got UEA, they got the Board of Education on board. But there are some groups, Voices for Utah Children, for example, that are concerned that this is sort of putting off the bigger discussion about how we fund things in the state. And also, you know, will this inevitably pit these programs for children and disabled Utahns against education? And if that happens, does that mean the slice that they're getting is going to be smaller going forward? It's a complicated issue and one that I think voters are going to have a bit of a hard time wrapping their brains around. It's not intuitive in a lot of ways.
Well, so what do Utah voters do if they don't know that much about it? If it seems a little complicated, do they give the benefit of the doubt to the lawmakers and vote for it? Or do they act suspicious of lawmakers and vote against it?
I mean, that's a million-dollar question. And people on both sides of this issue are wondering the same thing, frankly. I think there is a considerable amount of distrust for legislators in general. Do we trust them to honor their commitments? And Ben, I think you've looked at this issue before, and we've seen it before, where if there's an issue on the ballot the voters don't understand, they oftentimes default to no.
It has happened before, and this is one I think it would have been a lot more contentious of a campaign for and against this thing if not for COVID. Voters are just going to have to do their own homework, make their own decision on this one, because there really isn't a lot of campaigning for and against this that I've seen just anywhere.
So what is election day going to look like? Robert Gerke, what do you think? Like, how safe is it going to be? Is that, you know, how busy are polling locations going to be? What do you think it'll look like?
Yeah, I was talking to the Salt Lake County clerk the other day and state elections officials, and they both are hoping that it's not busy. They want as many people as possible to vote before Election Day because they don't want long lines of potential COVID spreaders coming out to polling places. And so they're really putting a push on getting the ballots in early, doing the vote by mail, either in a drop box or in a mailbox. But it is entirely possible, particularly in close races in the 4th District, that we won't know who won for another week or 2 weeks after the election. And I think we also need to prepare nationally that there's a possibility that we won't know who won the presidency, because there's going to be states with close races that are going to factor into the Electoral College, and they may be counting votes for days after the election too. And so it's going to be very different than what we're used to.
So let me ask you all, how does Utah change if Joe Biden wins? Ben Winslow.
When it comes to policy, I think the state, at least all the state leaders, are going to be playing defense.
Which means what, do you think?
You may see some initiatives similar to Obama-era initiatives that are advanced by the White House that maybe Utah leaders don't like, either in the legislature or in the executive branch. You may see that dealing with healthcare. You could see a return of national monuments. You could see a lot of things that the Trump administration undid getting redid.
Well put. Sonia, what do you think? What changes as far as you can guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ben is totally right. I think there is going to be a lot of trying to anticipate things that, you know, they think a Biden administration would do. I could definitely see some movement on gun rights / gun control, trying to, you know, prevent gun control that, you know, Republican leaders maybe think go too far. That's definitely one issue that we would want to keep an eye out for.
Robert, do the monuments come back?
I think they do. I was going to say that's probably the most certain thing that we'll see is the return to of the monuments under a Biden presidency. I think particularly if Democrats take control of the Senate and keep control of the House, then you see a lot of the state's efforts shifting into the courts, because especially with the Supreme Court confirmation hearing going on right now, the movement of the courts to a more conservative judiciary. And we saw that during the Obama years. We saw the Attorney General leading out on a lot of state issues. We're seeing the attorneys general across the state now trying to get the healthcare, Obamacare rescinded. And I think that's going to be the front where Utah government and Utah's sort of fight against the Biden administration. And so it's sort of going to be a flashback to the 2008 timeframe where we saw a lot of anti-Obama, anti-Democrat efforts in Utah. And I would anticipate that'll be the theme for the coming 4 years under a Biden presidency.
It's Robert Gerke. He's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. Ben Winslow is a reporter for Fox 13. And Sonia Hudson covers politics for KUER. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.